Welcome to the Herd Quitter Podcast. I'm your host, Jared Lumen. On this show, we talk to farmers and ranchers who aren't afraid to think for themselves and do things a little bit differently. We hope these guests will challenge you to look at your farms and ranches in a new way and result in a more profitable and enjoyable business for you and your family. Hello and welcome back to the Herd Quitter Podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to give a quick shout out to my sponsor, Barn to Door. Barn to Door is a solution built for farmers that my wife and I use to grow and manage our direct marketing business. And if you're looking to access more customers, Barn to Door can help your farm build brand awareness on the web, mobile, social, and email to access a wider audience. In fact, my wife and I have worked with Barn to Door now for several years and have seen our registered customer base increase 5 times, which has helped provide more consistent cash flow for our family. You can go to www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter where you can learn more about our success. And if you choose to sign up, you'll get access to a free academy session that's a $99 value. Again, the website is www.barntodoor.com/herdquitter, and I'll have that link in the show notes. Now, to today's episode, we've got Cal Hartich on the podcast, who is actually a fellow podcaster. He hosts the Grazing Grass podcast. He's also a farmer and rancher from Oklahoma and is doing awesome stuff with cattle and sheep and goats down there. And so I'm looking forward to sharing this conversation with you that we had a few weeks ago. Also, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about myself and our farm, he actually had me on his podcast several weeks ago now, maybe a month or so ago. Again, that's the Grazing Grass podcast. I'd really encourage you to go take a listen to it. It's on the list of one of the episodes that I listen to pretty regularly. So feel free to check that out. But with that, we'll dive into today's conversation with Cal Hartich. Well, Cal, thanks so much for joining me and welcome to the Herd Quitter podcast.
Jared, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's always fun to get to, for everyone listening, they won't know, but we just had a good conversation just before. It's fun to talk to other podcasters. When you had me on yours, we had probably more conversation outside of the podcast almost than we did during. It's fun to get to talk to other folks doing the same thing. So I appreciate the willingness to join me.
I completely agree. And it's something we need more of, I think, just as podcasters.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, no, for sure. None of us have it figured out, but we're going to talk a little bit about your podcast for sure, but I'm excited to hear more about you and your farm and your experience in agriculture and grazing grass and why you've gotten into that. For those who aren't familiar with him, his podcast is the Grazing Grass Podcast. So it's a topic that we're both passionate about that I'm looking forward to hearing. But maybe, I guess, to start us off, dive into your history a little bit. Did you grow up in agriculture? Were you always passionate about grazing grass, or how did you come to be?
Some of my earliest memories are on the farm. My dad's always had a farm. My grandparents on both sides farmed. My mom's dad, he always had an off-the-farm job and then ran some beef cattle. And then my dad's dad.
Sure.
My mom's dad, they dairied my whole life. It's all I can remember. We used to get to go out there for a week during the summer. I loved going out there because we got to milk and I enjoyed that so much. So I have a large amount of history on the farm and with the farm, but usually it's with an off the farm job. So it's not necessarily, just a sole income coming from that. Grandpa, dad's dad. Boy, maybe we should edit what I call him. That'd be great. So no, we can figure that one out. Dad's dad, he worked off the farm and had beef cattle. My dad worked off the farm and we had hogs all through the 70s. And towards the late 70s, we sold them. So I have some memories of those and going out there and feeding them. We also had beef cattle. I hate to even say the word hobby farm, but a hobby farm, sure. 20 head of cows, but always had that. And then when I was just a teenager, dad changed jobs and we decided, I say we decided like I had a decision in this. I really didn't. Mom and dad decided we were going to dairy. And we started dairying with my grandparents, who at that time my uncle was dairying as well. So the
Okay.
three families all dairied together for a few years. And then at the end of that time, grandpa retired. My uncle continued dairying, and we had built our own dairy.
Really?
So I loved dairy. I was not the smartest kid in the class, obviously, because I went to college to get an animal science degree to come home to dairy. And while I was at college, I worked on the OSU dairy. So I enjoyed it. I still, if I could milk a few cows now, I'd probably be really close to it. So came home after college, I got my animal science degree. And that's a funny story I cover on one of my podcast episodes, why I almost didn't get my college degree, which would have been really detrimental for some other things later on in life. Anyway, I
Sure.
got my degree and came home and started dairying with my folks. I bought cows. We dairied, I guess, 5 years. And then we decided, made the hard decision to sell out. And
Okay.
during that time, we also put in chicken houses, which conventional chicken houses, the reason for that, we had two families need to make a living on the dairy.
Yeah.
So then chicken houses provided a really stable income there. And then you had the dairy providing the income. So in
Yeah.
99, we sold out on the dairy. And because I'm looking, thinking, what am I going to do now? I didn't own land. I just sold all my milk cows. I could have invested in something at that point, but I decided to go back to school for education. And because I had a bachelor's degree, it was fairly easy to make that career path adjustment. And I went back and got an early childhood degree and started teaching.
Okay.
So
So,
during the next 23 years, I taught.
okay. All right. I wanna dive into a little bit of what you've talked already about because I'm curious or intrigued. You said your dad kind of started dairying with a change of jobs. Was that so he was still working while dairying at that time? He was just.
No, he decided he had resigned from his job and we started dairying.
With
So
your
when
uncle at
with
the
my
with it.
grandparents,
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
and uncle.
Okay, cool. And so while they were daring that, how did he come to have his own dairy? Was this like a progression while working on one, or when grandpa retired, he just kind of split off and went out and started his own thing?
So once we moved out, we lived south of Chelsea. And when we started dairying, we moved north to Chelsea. And the first thing we remodeled an old house and we lived there. And then dad sold the land at Bushy Head, which is south of Chelsea. When he sold that land, he got an opportunity to buy land here. And it's 2 miles from my parents' house.
Okay.
And so once we bought that, the worst summer of my life was converting the old house that stood on this place into a dairy barn.
A house.
We took it. Yes, it had an old house on it, and we were able to figure out how to restructure it by keeping the outer walls, a couple of load-bearing walls, and the roof in place and turn it into a dairy. So it
Wow.
obviously it wasn't a slab house, but
Yeah.
it had rock foundation and stuff. But so we tore the floor out, tore out the subfloor, and we dug the pit by hand because you couldn't get machinery in there.
Yeah.
And you ask my brother or I, my brother's 2 years younger than me.
Yeah.
That was the summer that never ended
Yeah, I bet.
because we would go milk just up the road at my grandpa's. Get finished, go home, eat breakfast. Then we'd come down to the place, as we called it, and we'd work on the dairy barn.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, my brother and I went in to dig on the pit while dad had to do something else to get something
Yeah.
taken care of. As I recall, it was 24/7. Now, I'm sure my dad doesn't recall it being that extensive.
Yeah.
Actually, I know he doesn't because we've talked about this. And I said, that's all we did. It was hot. And we were in there digging in hard clay because it's under this house. It's dry. It was up on a little bit of a hill, not much of one, but enough of one that This ground was hard. It was awful doing.
Yeah.
Awful.
Well,
As
and I was going
that's
to
my
ask
positive memory.
for some context, let people know where you are and what a summer and
Oh
where
yeah.
you are is like. Because I'm in Minnesota and that sounds miserable, but I'm sure it's a little different where you're at.
I'm in Northeast Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So we get about 43, 44 inches of rain a year. Summers are our fifth season of high summer when it's nice and hot and dry. And we were off from school, and that's when we were in there. Normally during summers, we have between, I'd say, 5 to 10 up to 20 days over 100 degrees. So
Wow.
during those summer days, it can get pretty warm. So, and we have really good soil where we are, or pretty
Sure.
decent soil, but under that house, it was not.
Yep. No, hot, miserable labor, very labor intensive work. I do not envy that. No, that's cool. So your dad then started his dairy there, and the chicken barns is something I'm always intrigued of because still today, I mean, you talk about coming home and being a part of the farm. You had multiple generations trying to make a living off of a farm. That's still a pretty common method of bringing in a new generation. In our area, there's a lot of hog barns, and a lot of my friends in my generation, that's how they got home, is they built their own or, a couple hog
Oh,
barns. So
yes.
yeah, I guess was that your kind of thing, or was that your parents? What happened when the with those when the dairy
So
quit?
basically when we decided on the chicken houses became mom and dad's, and I ran the dairy. So, and when I say that, the dairy was still theirs, but I provided a ton of the work for it. And was I provided ton of the work. I was the manual labor. And then like a third of the cows I owned. So getting started. And once we had the chicken houses in place, obviously I'd have to go help them whenever they needed help, especially during clean out and stuff. But I would also hire a high school kid to milk once in a while so I could have some downtime.
So that was your parents, and when the dairy, when you sold out of the dairy, did they continue to do those chicken barns to bring their own income, or?
They did. And in fact, so even though I was going back to school and started teaching, I continued to work up there and help them with that. And then that was, so we sold out in 99. Dad sold the chicken houses, I want to say like 03 or 04. So they just did it a few more years. It's very physical labor. My parents had dairied for years. That's quite a toll on a body for both of them. And they sold the chicken houses, and they helped a guy from Minnesota had came down and purchased them, and they helped him go with it. And it was a little bit beyond his ability, and he ended up giving it back to the bank. At that point, my parents purchased it back with the agreement we would not run chickens there, which
Interesting.
at that point, that was not a worry in the world. Had enough of chickens, at least on that scale.
So that part of my question I was going to ask here, you just answered there with I've had enough of chickens. But I'm curious your overall thoughts because I get mixed feel I have mixed feelings on it all. I mean, as a grazer, I love grazing. I love the open. I love the land ownership and stuff as opposed to buildings. But I see that as just a very good opportunity for young people to get into agriculture is in some sort of a contract barn. How do you feel about them yourself?
I have very conflicting views on it. I was reintroduced to, pasture management, grass farming, managing your forages through the Stockman Grass Farmer in the late 80s. I know when I came home and dairied, we started doing some rotational grazing through using some energizers that just did not work very good. For one thing, we were trying to get by with cheap stuff. And it just didn't work as good as we wanted it to. I was learning. Dad was okay with me playing with it as long as I didn't affect milk production too much because that would be a big problem. But trying to figure that out, and then we put in the chicken houses. And I don't, I actually I have a few chickens now, but they're not raised in a big barn like that. Those
Yeah.
barns were 40 by 400,
Wow. Yeah.
which is a small barn now because they build huge barns, and each barn held like 21, 22,000 birds. I did not like going in them. It's so dusty and stuff, and you can't get that smell off of you, kind of like pigs. You can't get that smell off of you.
Yeah.
However, it provided a need at the time. We needed a steadier income, and it
Yeah.
did that. And then the other thing was spreading the chicken litter on the land. We had so Dad bought 240 acres here in their mid early to mid 80s. I know I take that back. He purchased it in 87, I think. So
Okay.
that we're a little bit late 80s.
Sure.
160 of it is nice ground that I say 160, most of 160 is free nice ground. There is probably 30 on one corner that's been dug, that's a big pond that they left that's been reclaimed. And then 80 of it was reclaimed land. And when they dug that for coal, they went through, they dug it in the 50s or 60s, my understanding, and they just left it as piles
Sure.
like they did back then.
Yeah.
Then when money came available to reclaim this land, they went and leveled it all out. And there's no topsoil up there. In fact, in 87, we baled hay here. And to store the hay, we went up in the middle of a bare spot and put four corner posts and built a hay pen. And
My
it
God.
was not for a couple hundred bales of hay. And it
Yeah.
was not anywhere in that pen any grass, just huge bare area.
Wow. Okay.
And through management, Dad's always believed we should be rotating cattle. So
Yeah.
we would, Dad's very much into, we have permanent paddocks,
Okay.
decent size. They actually need cut down for tighter rotations, but they work really good for a loose rotation. And that's basically the way Dad managed it. And
Sure.
we were seeing improvement on that reclaimed land. But when we got chicken houses, chicken litter can make rocks grow grass.
Yeah,
It
sure.
is amazing.
Yeah.
You got to be aware of, we have to do soil tests, had to make sure we weren't spreading too much, can
Yeah.
be from water areas. But it's amazing how much, and in fact, some of that reclaimed land that we spread chicken litter on for 8 years is some of our best ground now.
Wow.
And part of it is we don't hay it at all either because it's rough because it's reclaimed land.
Sure.
So we do
Yeah.
bale hay on another portion that would have always been considered the best land. But when you hay, you're always pulling nutrients from it. So
Yeah.
that land's going to degrade.
Sure.
And for a long time, we fertilized, we sprayed. But since probably for last 10 years, I've really leaned into no chemical inputs, no fertilizer. We're just managing what we have and letting the soil heal from all that treatment. Now, Dad is not quite there because Dad still talks about once in a while, maybe we should go spray that pasture. No, let's just take a break because we added sheep because we were trying to figure out a way to not spray some pastures.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, and especially for us, those weeds are there for mismanagement. I have one pasture that's fairly big. It's about 25 or 30 acres. We call it the day pasture because that's where the cows went during the day.
Okay. Yep.
I only have water point in at one spot in that pasture. So I'm trying to manage it and get it in better shape. But that pasture was overgrazed for a long, long time. And
Yeah.
we're still working to repair that land or that paddock, especially the other paddocks. It's amazing what they can do. That paddocks, I still have too many weeds. And I hate to say weeds. We got the sheep to help graze that, and we're utilizing as much as we can, but it's still not the quality I have in other pastures.
Yeah, we dove all into kind of a lot of what you're doing now, which I definitely want to get into as well. Especially like it's cool that you have this like side by side trial of what you considered to be good land versus what you considered to be very poor land. And I think those are kind of
Oh
fun to
yeah.
see how management impacts it. But we'll dive into that even more once we get in your we're kind of walking through your story when we get caught up to where you're at. But that was interesting. You kind of have mixed feelings on the the chicken barns, which is super understandable. That regular cash flow is so important, and that, like, back then especially, you could get a barn bought and lock in a 15-year contract on the birds and pay off the barn in 8 and whatever, and it was great. Today it's almost like land, where even the contract doesn't even pay for the building almost anymore. But
Oh,
it's
yeah.
a little different story today, it seems like. But glad it sounds
Well,
like it was a good part of your family's story, I guess, at the time.
it worked out, but just about the time they were about to pay stuff off or really make lots of progress, the company came in and said we need to close it up and make a wind
Oh,
tunnel because it was open
yeah,
sides with curtains.
sure.
So
Yeah.
that meant you had to, so the houses were refinanced and
Yeah.
it brought that debt load back up.
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes when you're doing that, you're like, is that their goal? You know, I'm not much for conspiracy theories, but you know,
Yeah.
sometimes you're like, are they just trying to keep me
Keep
in
us
more
in
debt
debt.
and keep me going?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's where I like the idea of custom grazing, because you get that consistent income,
Oh.
but it's like your infrastructure investment is minimal, and you can do it in land. Now, if it paid for it over 50, if it paid for farmland over 15 years, like the barns used to work, that would be amazing. And I don't think we're there yet, but
Oh, yeah.
we can
Yeah.
hope. No, cool. So you sold out of the dairy in 99 and you went to teaching. What did you teach,
Yes.
and were you still involved in the farm at that point? How involved were you versus your parents? Did you think you were done with ag at that point? What were you thinking?
I did not think I was done at ag because I knew I wanted to be in ag the whole time. I
Sure.
just could not see a roadmap to get there. So I continued to help dad. We ran beef cattle, dad's cattle. I helped on weekends. I helped all summers. He'd work me a death during summers. I'd get home. I can remember one summer. So we tore down one of those chicken houses after we got it back. I can remember day after school was out and I checked out of school. I was on top of that roof pulling nails out so we could reuse that tin
Yeah.
and rebuild those barns. And my hands, when you're teaching, your hands are not made for that manual work. It was
Yeah.
quite the job.
Adaption, yeah. It's
But
like, it reminds me of when I ran a marathon once, and I had trained all the time. And then after the marathon, I took months off and I didn't run. And then I got asked to go run a 10K. And when I ran, my brain was telling me, last time you ran 26 miles, you should be fine. But my body was telling me, stop, you're dying. And so
oh,
it's what
yeah.
you're thinking of there, probably. When you grew up on a farm, your brain is telling me, I farmed my whole life, I can handle this. But your
Oh,
body's like,
yeah.
you're a teacher, you haven't done this in very long.
Right. Yes. So
Yeah.
during my teaching career, I started out teaching 4K, 4-year-olds,
Okay.
because that's where I really, the reason I got into teaching was my kids had started going to school. And
Sure.
as a dairyman, I had more flexibility with my time. And the teacher says on Fridays, we cook. We would love to have parent volunteers. So I thought, I'll go in. I can help. It'll be fun. And I found I really enjoyed teaching and
Yeah.
being around the kids. So that's what caused me to really consider education, because at that
Sure.
point, before that, I hadn't considered education. And so we sold out the dairy. I thought education is a nice off-the-farm job. I still have a lot of time on the farm.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that went into the reasoning. And I taught pre-K up to 5th grade. I've taught computers to pre-K through 5th grade. I've
Sure.
also been a technology director, a technology coach. So I've been in administration. In fact, I was in administration and decided I wanted to focus on the farm. And if I don't do it soon, my body is not going to agree with me.
Sure.
And what brought that to a head was, you know, when you're 20 or 30 and you hurt yourself, you're like, oh, I did this and I hurt myself. At a certain point, parts hurt and I don't know why they hurt. So my knee started bothering me.
Sure.
And my brother's a doctor. I went and saw him and he x-rayed it and I got an MRI and it needs some tender TLC.
Yeah.
And probably eventually I'm looking at a knee replacement. But that really woke me up that if I want to do this full time, I need to do it. I need to do it.
Yeah.
So that caused me to take this leap off
Yeah.
into doing this full time. We'll see how it goes. I still, because of the teaching industry right now, teacher shortage. If I want to go back in a classroom, I can.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, the farming handles it. And the Grazing Grass podcast was started kind of a combination of my passion of ag and teaching.
Yeah.
So it really combines the two. So I would love to be able just to continue to focus on those.
That's awesome. I love that goal. I have a similar goal, and I think that's definitely possible. So you, while you were teaching, though, you said you were still involved in the farm. What did the progression of the farm look like as far as its enterprises? And I guess I didn't ask, when you were dairying, was it primarily a grazing dairy, or were you raising crops on that land? But I guess, yeah, when did the shift to grass come from, I guess, after that?
We're a grazing dairy. There's zero farming that happens within 30 minutes to an hour of me.
Sure.
So it's grazing. We fed the cows in the dairy barn, just a grain concentrate that they had. We didn't feed a TMR, silage, or anything else. So it was the grain in the barn, hay, and grass.
Okay.
So we were not pushing for a ton of production. We were working with, we were using hostings, but not huge hostings, not like some hostings they have up north.
Yeah.
We always call those huge ones northern.
Yeah.
So we were doing that, and I started, the more I read, starting in the late 80s, when I went to college in the 90s, I wanted to do a New Zealand type grazing dairy. That was too far for dad.
Okay.
So he let me manage the grazing at the house. And to be honest, it just, we were running too many animals here to really do grazing good. We had a day pasture and a night pasture. I could use a little bit of electric fencing to rotate them. But we were, at the time when we were dairying, we were set stocked. Here we had a dry cow pasture. Here we had a heifer pasture.
Yeah.
We'd move some of these different livestock classes to certain pastures, and that's just where they stayed.
Yeah.
Very, very different mindset from where I was trying to go.
Yeah.
When we sold out and dad got beef cattle, we already had these pastures, because dad had believed in moving cattle or rotating cattle before. But then when we dairied, we just, you couldn't do that because of how many different classes of livestock we had and the way we were managing them. So when we sold out dairy, dad bought beef cattle, and then we started doing a little bit of rotation. Sure. It was during that time I continued my learning. Probably what kicked me into most, or in the highest gear on rotational grazing, was early 2000. I'd started teaching, and I purchased some goats. I got some meat goats, and I knew from reading, well, I knew I wanted to do rotationally manage them. I knew I had to, from a management, a parasite management perspective as well, but I wanted to do it from the grass perspective. So I think I had 7 or 8 paddocks here, permanent paddocks with wire. It was soft electric fence wire, because I'm trying to figure out how to do this electric fencing.
Sure.
It did not go well. For one, the goats I started with came from show lines, so they weren't really as hardy as I'd liked. And then I didn't know what I was doing with the electric fencing. To be honest, I'd played with it before, but I still just didn't know. But I was trying to, and it'd work okay. And then they were out. I mean, that drove dad crazy when they get out.
Yeah.
And I just had trouble with it. And I think during that time, Greg Judy's first book came out. And I've read these other books on management and on intensive grazing and managing grass and holistic management, but I didn't have anyone here that I could go visit and see how they're doing it. Now now I know there were some people around, but I didn't know where they were. I didn't know who to talk to. Greg Judy's book came out Let's see, no risk ranching,
Yeah.
which really opened my eyes. And some of his stuff, he's very pragmatic. He says, here's what you should go do.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's right or wrong, sometimes we need that. We
Yeah.
need go put that wire at 10 inches, then at 16 inches, then at 24, and try it. Everything happens in context, and we have to think about, well, what works here may not work there, but we have to be careful with analysis paralysis and we don't take that next step. And that's where I was. I
Sure.
knew what I was wanting to do. I wasn't having great success at it. I was moving these goats on a time-based plan because I was trying to minimize parasites. My electric fences were only halfway working. I loved the goats, or I would have got rid of them immediately. Goats have such personalities. They're probably my favorite animal on the farm. They're the most difficult to deal with,
Yes.
but in our marriage, my wife would say I'm the most difficult to deal with. So, give and take there.
Yes.
But so Greg Judy's put out that book, and I don't know if it's his book or I'd heard about it before, but I got a Stay-Fix Energizer. Changed my world because I did two things. One, I spent for a quality Energizer. I
Yeah.
wasn't just buying the cheapest one at a local tractor supply store.
Sure.
Makes all to for me, in my context, made all the difference, especially when you're running wire for goats 8 inches off the ground or 6 inches off the ground so they don't crawl under. That
Yeah.
thing's got to be hot. And
Absolutely.
then the other
Yeah.
thing was something we had never done, even though we had energizers. We had never done a good job with the grounding system. You've got to do the grounding system correctly. And that means putting in multiple ground rods, depending on how many joules your energizer is, but you've got to do that. We always took and just clipped it to the barbed wire fence, which
Sure.
should be good, but
Yeah.
who knows those little alligator clips, how good they're going to really make a contact. So I think a lot of the trouble I had with electric fences are those two reasons. One, I bought a cheap electric fencer or energizer, and I never grounded the system good. Probably at times it grounded okay. When I made those changes, it made a world of change to my operation and how I could manage the goats. And I ended up moving away from those original goats I had and moving into Kiko's. And we had up to, I think probably the most I ever had was 50 or 60 does. But that got me interested in the goats. The cattle were still going. And then in, I want to say 2011, I went up to Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri. And Greg Judy was a speaker there. And it was a small ruminants conference. And as I recall, every person there had hair sheep except me. Part of them had goats with them. I was the only producer there that only had goats. And they all told me I needed to get goats. I mean, get hair sheep. I needed
Sure.
to get hair sheep.
Yeah.
So came home. I talked to Dad about this and I'm convinced him over a number of years that we needed to do this. And we started looking for a decent sized flock of hair sheep.
Yeah.
Now, if you go on Craigslist today, Facebook Marketplace, well, not really Marketplace, Facebook groups, you can find you a decent sized flock of hair sheep today.
Yeah.
Back then, I looked and looked and I could find three, five ewes, but I couldn't find a flock. And I wanted a flock because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't want to put them together. So I found a flock. I believe it was 2015. I finally found a flock of 30 ewes, which now that doesn't sound very big at all, but that was the largest I'd seen. So
Yeah.
we went and looked at it. The guy told me a great story about it. And in my naiveness, we purchased them.
Okay.
And they were all bred for fall lambing. And so we thought we were in great shape. He'd raised them all again, thought it was great. Got them home. Fall came. We bought them in August and they were supposed to start lambing in November. November came. We didn't have any lambs. And
Okay.
I hate to admit this, You know, now I could look at that flock and say, those aren't all raised on one farm. But at the time, I didn't realize it. Some of
Sure.
the tails were docked, some weren't.
Okay.
You get to looking at the scrapie tags, I had different states of origin with them. All stuff that's pretty obvious to a person with average intelligence. But I was blinded to it because I was so eager to get started in it.
Yeah.
And we spend a lot of time fixing that flock, selling anything that doesn't shed or
Yeah.
doesn't do right, has any kind of parasite problems. And we have a nice sheep flock now, but that was a learning curve, much steeper than I want to admit as well.
Yeah.
So we did sheep, started in I think 2015 is when we purchased those.
Okay.
And I had the goats at the time, and then I sold the goats in like 2017
And your dad was still
because,
running a beef herd as well through this
yeah,
whole
we
time?
still ran all the beef cattle. So
Okay.
we started running. So if you've got beef cattle, you can run one ewe per cow and not affect your stocking rate because they're going to eat enough different species that you can maintain that without hurting it. So dad was running about 50 cows. We purchased and we started running them on the land. Now the sheep, rotationally grazing the sheep did not respect our interior fences very well.
Yeah.
We are currently working to make that better. But the sheep were much more active. So they actually did a little bit more rotational grazing on their part. And also we were stocking sheep at a low enough density that parasites weren't a huge issue.
Okay.
I think what they, if you've got two ewes, less than two ewes per acre, parasites are using not a big issue because you got a big enough area for them to
Sure.
graze. And we were also running cattle in the same area. So
Okay.
cattle were grazing that area as
Were
well.
you were doing like a flirt? They were running together, actually.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
At times it would appear to be a flirt
Okay.
because they were in the same pasture,
Yeah.
but at times they weren't because the sheep didn't respect interior fences.
Sure.
So basically what we had was 380s.
Okay.
And sheep could stay on this 80, or we'd move them to this 80 or the next 80. And if the cattle happened to be in a paddock on that 80, the sheep may join them or may not.
Sure.
So
Okay.
we weren't managing them separate. We were managing the sheep very loosely,
Sure.
just because of numbers.
Yeah.
And even then, when I say it was 80s, it was very general. Our fences weren't as tight as they needed to be.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that makes sense. That's interesting, actually. Yeah. It at those numbers, like you're saying, you probably can just like kind of let them be sparse and spread out, and they're not going to make a big impact. They can graze freely what they want and probably worked pretty well for you.
And that took most of our pastures from what we would call good pastures with a few weeds or forages out there that we weren't quite as desirable of, to pastures that you drive down the road and they look weed free.
Yeah.
Because, well, for one, the sheep just clear them out. You don't get, I mean, kuckaburra, as soon as they pop up a leaf, that sheep's on it.
Really? So even with that
So.
kind of that density that's completely selective, they can pick and choose whatever they want. They still chose the weeds over grasses.
They did. In fact, based upon the way those pastures were, if you're doing any kind of grazing management and your fencing can handle it, a few sheep will make a tremendous impact upon your grass
Wow.
species out there. And what it did for us, it increased our grass species because that lamb's quarter, that kuckaburra, they just consume it and it doesn't get a chance to spread or anything else.
Yeah.
And of course, if you're managing your land, you're working away from that anyway. But the sheep
Yeah.
just really helped that. And the goats
Wow.
helped it as well. But we can't run goats, or we couldn't run goats on as big of area because they require better fencing.
Sure. That's really interesting. I assumed that their preference would be grass like cattle, but in a given no choice or in some sort of a non-selective environment, that they would then eat more things than cattle maybe would. But it actually surprises me that they would go out and pick and choose the weeds. That's perfect. That's like just a broadcast. You don't very minimal labor, let them go out and pick and choose
Oh.
what you want them to eat anyway. So.
Yeah, that it's worked amazingly well. Now, there's some things they don't like bitter weed. they're not a fan of.
Sure.
And of course, you can control a lot of bitterweed by better grazing management so
Yeah.
that you don't get it short in late summer when bitterweed
Sure.
really takes off.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Cool. So, the sheep, you talked about improving the herd or the flock, the genetics. What were you doing? You were just culling hard, and what were your selection criteria with the sheep?
We were culling hard and we purchased registered Katahdin rams then. So we were using registered stock or registered rams and we were culling really hard on them.
Okay.
We were keeping every ewe lamb born, provided. Now, I say that as the years go on, we get more selective of what we're keeping. But still, at this point, we're keeping the majority of our ewe lambs because we've been growing the flock.
Sure.
Now we are at a point that I'm not sure we will keep ewe lambs, or we will keep some ewe lambs this year, but I'm not
Yeah.
sure we will keep all of them. In fact, we will probably offer a fair number for sale.
Okay. Sort of a
Because,
replacement versus an expansion rate of retention. Yeah.
right, we're about 150 ewes right now.
Okay. Sure. And the selection criteria you were saying, was that just like, did you just let the ones that thrived? I mean, well, like you said, you kept everything, but as you start to do this, do you have a selection criteria that you hope to pick based off of, or?
So the whole time we have culled, if they don't shed good, they go to town. If we have to worm them, they go to town. So those have been really tough criteria we've implemented. And at first, we sold off a lot of ewes that didn't shed good. Now, I think I had one ewe last year that went to town because she didn't shed good. They
Sure.
shed good. Worm or parasite issues will cause them to get a trip to town. And we're still in that learning mode because each time you increase the number of sheep you're running, that causes you some problems. And we ran into
Yeah.
some problems with sheep last year with lambs that we're working to get ready for this year that'll fix that issue. What
Okay.
it was, when we weaned our ram lambs, we put them in a pasture at my house and pulled that pasture out of the rotation and we just kept them in there. And I had two sides of the driveway I moved them from. Obviously, I know that's not going to work, but it worked in the case for us because it's the only pastures we had that would hold ram lambs good enough. And last year was a little wetter during late summer than it normally is, and we had a parasite wreck. That's totally on management. So one thing we're working on, in fact, my dad and my nephew's out there right now working on it. We are adding a wire to interior fences so that
Okay.
we can manage the rotation of sheep. And
Sure.
then we're also increasing, we've got a couple pastures that are in field wire or goat wire. We're increasing that a little bit so that when we wean them, we have better control of those. And when we first started, we weaned everything. We banded everything. It was a wrestling match. It was awful. I would come in and I was sure I lost the match.
Yeah.
Because I'm out there grabbing them one at a time doing it. Since then, when we sowed some, we purchased a sheep alleyway. Makes a tons of difference. I can run them through there. It's got a sort gate on it. And then we decided to quit banding the rams. Now we've actually made the decision we will band rams this year.
Okay.
We think it will help with management, and we're not entirely sure, but we're wondering if we get a little bit better price if they're banded.
Okay.
We originally didn't think we were, so we quit banding them. But
Sure.
that created more headaches because we got to make sure those ram lambs don't get to use.
Yeah.
So, and one of those side effects is accidental lambing season, which has been going on here.
Yeah.
They weren't supposed to lamb already, but I had a
Sure.
ram lamb get out.
Okay. Well, that seems to happen to everyone at some point, but with
Yeah.
cattle, whatever. But cool. So the sheep, I guess, to contrast them to the cattle, what is the cattle production system, genetics system? What are you doing with the cow side, and do you prefer one over the other, or what are your thoughts between the two?
So for the cattle, when we sold out dairy and started buying cattle, Dad bought cheap cows through the sale barn. So we had a little bit of mix of everything. But we started using limousine bulls because that's what my grandpa, when he retired, he purchased limousine cattle and has been running limousine cattle since then. So we started purchasing limousine bulls, and we use those, I would say, from 99 when Dad started all the way up to, I don't know, probably about 10 years ago. But late, probably 07 through 10. And we were also selling all of our calves to Laura's Lean Beef. So we wanted a certain type of that limousine. Yeah. But they only had three producers up here in this area they were getting cattle from. It was one load, and they decided we were too far away from. They were hauling them to Texas or sure. maybe. No, they weren't. They were going to feedlot up in Nebraska. But they decided there wasn't enough of us in this area because there was just three of us
sure.
right down the road. My neighbor, us, and my grandpa.
Sure.
So at that point, we also noticed that we were feeding calves out, spending tons of money to get this weight on them, and they were crazy. I apologize to all limousine breeders because I know there's some docile ones out there, but ours, those steers get 800, 900 pounds. They were pretty nervous. And Dad almost got ran over one day when I was at school, and he sure. was loading them out. They yeah. ran in, hit the front of the trailer, turned around, and before he could get to the trailer close, they were back on top of him, knocked him down, and he grabbed a hold of the stock or the trailer gate, and amazingly, he did not get stepped on or hurt. Sure. Extremely lucky then. But we made the decision then. We stayed with limousine, but we became very particular about the limousine we used. We were using a lot of full-blood limousine, but then we became very particular that we wanted very docile full-blood limousines. And also at that time, we started going to a more moderate size, trying to bring down some size.
Sure.
So we used those for a long time. I say a long time, 5, 7 years, something like that. We went through a few limousine bulls. We really made a tremendous difference in the docility of our cow herd. Mm-hmm. Our cows are calm. And then we started changing from limousine when we felt like we weren't able to get those heifers bred to calve at 2 years of age.
Sure.
Late maturing, or ours were. And we just were not running a high enough percentage. So we were pushing these heifers to get to a certain size, then putting them with a bull, then we'd preg check them, and we weren't running a high enough percentage.
Sure.
And you spend all that money, you need them all into production. Mm-hmm. So we started looking at what other breeds would complement what we had. And at the time, of course, I'm reading more, and I'm convinced we need to go smaller animals. Mm-hmm. So we found our first voyage into that with Dad's herd was South Devons.
Okay.
And we found a breeder in Kansas with some nice moderate-sized South Devons that his cow herd were cookie cutters, which yeah. I loved.
Yeah.
And we brought two of those bulls in and started a process.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, we've dabbled in Gelvie. We've dabbled in Beefmaster. My dad's always been a fan of Beefmaster. I was introduced yeah. to Tom Lasseter's book
yep.
at an early age, The Six Principles.
Yeah.
And so Beefmaster has always been very, dad's always been interested in it.
Sure.
So yeah. we got some Beefmaster bulls. Currently, we're using South Pole bulls because okay. the more I got into it, the more I believe that we needed to change that up more. And
yeah.
the stimulus for doing that is our cows weren't developing soon enough to calve at 2 years of age. And we firmly believe that a heifer needs to calve at 2 years of age to be profitable because mm-hmm. it's going to take a number of years for her to return that cost you have in her.
Sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And yeah, it seems to me like the right move going towards that moderate. I'm obviously a little biased, but I'm curious with your production model, both in the cattle and the sheep, how much are you feeding, supplementing? Are you grazing year round with both the cattle and the sheep? I don't know your context that well, but it seems to me like far enough south that you could potentially graze year round. But part of that is, I mean, choice too on how much, I don't know. Yeah, a lot of things to consider. So
for the, for the cattle, and we've done this for 20 years. We've worked to extend that grazing season. I do my best to stockpile cool seasons fescue because we have the ability to stockpile that. And we have probably, I would guess, in the last 20 years, maybe 1 year we fed hay before the first of the year,
Okay.
which is an increase. Most people's going to start in December here, maybe November, depending on the weather. We're still working to get that even further because I fully believe we can. We played with our numbers here on Dad's place. Dad's herd is a fall calving herd, so that affects it some too because you're going into winter with cows that need have a higher level of nutrition. For
Yeah.
Dad's herd, we do use protein blocks. He likes having them out there.
Sure.
Basically, we keep them out there year round. They eat them a lot sometimes. Sometimes they don't. Now, for the sheep, they have access to the same things, but the sheep don't. They hardly consume any hay. I
Really?
mean, if I'm dedicating, if I'm going through figures and I'm saying this bale went to sheep and this bale went to hay, to cattle, I'm in single digits for hay for sheep. And
Sure.
that's one huge thing as we look at our numbers. And that's one reason we're increasing sheep numbers
Yeah.
is the low cost of production. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned at this point, when we got the sheep, had them for a few years, we started increasing Dad's herd here. And we found a top end number for this land and we've really backed off of it. We hit some dry years. We played with
Yeah.
that number trying to figure it out. Some things happened to cause me to be, I'd read Greg Judy's No Risk Ranching, and I really wanted to find leased land. But
Yeah.
finding leased land is, or land to lease is really difficult.
Sure.
And I really leaned into that. A couple of things happened that caused me to say, if I'm going to do this, I've got to lean into it. So I leaned into it and was able to lease some land in 2020. So that's when I want to say I started my herd. And that's really what I started my current herd. Throughout all the other time, I'd have cattle. I wouldn't have cattle. I might have a little bit of land to graze. I might not. This is the first time I've had long-term leasing and not using any of Dad's land to do some
Sure.
things.
Yeah.
And my cows, I manage completely different, or I say completely different. They're not completely different. I expect them to graze as much as possible. I try and stockpile. Same thing for Dad. They don't get protein blocks though.
Okay.
They are grass-fed. I have purchased Corriente cows or Sapo cows. I did have some Limousine cows in. They basically eliminated themselves.
Yeah.
Had Red Angus. So I'm looking for a small to moderate red cow.
Yeah.
I like the Corrientes. I think they're a great cost-effective way to buy cows and produce a decent calf. And I'm using South Pole bulls on those. I'm calving in spring, late spring. So my energy, my nutritional requirements for those cows through winter are very low. So I have, what's that? Poor people have poor ways. Those cows make it through winter in a poor man's way. They do not get much extra, but I've found that I sometimes get concerned that maybe they're getting pulled down a little much by the end of winter, but right now we're going to start grazing in a couple of weeks and they will be back in good condition before calving.
Yeah.
And I have fed for the last number of years, I fed less than one bale of hay per cow
Wow.
for that herd. Now Dad's
Yeah.
herd, so for my herd, 40 bales of hay, Dad's going to feed 200, 250 bales of hay.
Wow. Okay.
But it's a different production model because he's calving in the fall and
Yeah.
those cows are nursing calves. We've got protein blocks and we do not limit feed hay. We
Sure.
put hay out there and they basically have all they want. We want them to clean it up decently, but we figure it's improving the land. We've got the hay. And the other great thing that we were a little slow to figure out, those old chicken houses are perfect for storing hay in. You pull
Perfect.
in there a house, 50 bales in a row. You can hold 200 bales real easy. Sometimes
Wow.
that fourth row is kind of difficult to get the arm up on that hay trailer,
Yeah.
but you can just pull in there and dump them out.
Oh,
It works
sure.
nice. That hay,
Yeah.
it can be in there years and we pull it out. It can be 2 or 3 years old and you pull it out and it's still in great shape.
Yeah.
That's a tremendous asset we have for helping us with high hay prices.
Yeah. Well, that's nice though that you can have access to hay if you need it. Buy like some people talk about the the hay prices they're managing by buying in the low years, and if you can store it for the bad years, or if you so you've always got it on hand in case you have a really nasty storm and you need it some year, but you don't want to have to buy it when everybody's needing it. I mean, that's huge.
Right.
Yeah. And I like that you have this ability to contrast the two different production models. I'm curious, and I've heard a few times throughout this conversation, you talk a little bit about how maybe your dad isn't the most open or willing to try different things that you want to try. And I don't want to bash him. This is not a negative on him because he's doing what he knows and has always known, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm curious, has that dynamic between you and your dad trying, how have you managed that, and what are your thoughts on that for somebody else who might be dealing with similar challenges of wanting to try something different, but maybe not getting the most approval or acceptance from the ownership generation, the management generation? Yeah, how have you navigated that?
For my dad, I think, he was really ahead of his time in that he wanted to rotate cattle. He knew there was a benefit of it, but he didn't want to do it as intensively as I wanted to. And that's been something our relationship working together has taken decades to get to the point where we are. I
Sure.
started, I worked for him when I was growing up, obviously, but when I
Yeah.
got out of college in 94, Christmas in 94, I came back home to Derry, and we a lot of butting heads there. And I think something that would have helped that I have more clarity now is to remember whose place it is. At the time, I thought I had all these wonderful ideas. I still have wonderful ideas in case anybody's asking.
Yeah.
But it's his place, the way he wants to do it. And what he's done, he's allowed me to do a little bit. So he heard me talk about grazing management, grass management a little bit. And it's to the point that I completely manage the grazing of his herd.
Sure.
I do manage it a little bit differently than me, than my herd because of the infrastructure we have in place.
Sure.
But he's much more open to these things than maybe he was 30 years ago. I'm much better at conveying what I think would work as well. I mean, I think we're very similar, and I think early on we probably butted heads a few too many times. But to know that it's his place, I'm here to help him get to where he wants to be. And we've talked about this. And in fact, the fall calving, we're having a discussion now with fall calving whether or not it's the best way to continue, because he's seen what I'm doing with my cows, and I'm feeding a fifth of what he's feeding. And when you start thinking about, we're very, very much grazing based. He does have a little bit of cost in those protein blocks. And then hay's the big cost there. So it's taken some time. And I know him and mom, it took a lot for them to stop feeding those wean calves like we did. We
Sure.
would put out a self feeder and pour the feed to them. And I'm like, we're not making any money with this. We're putting tons of money in. It's not working out on the end.
Yeah.
And that's what my mom grew up with. My grandpa and uncle, they still do that to their calves. They wean them, they pour the feed to them, and they sell a really nice 800-pound calf
Yeah.
that'll probably bring close to the top of the market. But that calf's too fat. And
Yeah,
I
way too
know
much
they put
in
too much
her.
money in there, in my view. Now, if that's the way they want to do it, have at it. But so dad's been open to those. It's just been slow. With my own herd, I'm able to do those things much more rapidly. And if I think something's going to work, I'm going to try it.
No, and that's cool. It seems like, and it's a common thing from people coming from a dairy production model. That's a very much maximum production. It's just a production kind of a
Oh,
mindset.
yeah.
Your goal is to produce as many pounds of milk or hundredweight or whatever. And when you transition that to a beef model and focus on production, and you think similarly that maximizing production will maximize profit, but it's just a totally different model. And it doesn't, I mean, I guess it works for some, and some people continue to do it, but we've found anyway, and it sounds like you're finding that you can do better focusing on more so managing grass, minimizing costs, making the cattle do the work for you, you're reducing direct and overhead costs. I mean, that's been the model that has
Oh
managed
yeah.
to work better for you.
Yeah, I'm trying to convince Dad. He's not quite, he lets me manage the grazing for his herd. And I say lets me because he does let me and I enjoy it. I
Sure.
enjoy that portion of it. And he's starting to consider some of these practices. Maybe they're not the best or the optimum practice and trying to figure that out. I keep pushing him to let me have a little bit more control over his herd. I think, well, I know I make more money with my cattle than he does. I'll just put it blank out there. I've told him that too.
Well, that's good. Now that and that I'll be interested to see as time goes on. It sounds like he's already starting to open up to more of your ideas, but that's important for people to hear. Challenge the paradigm, right? And if they're
Right.
really content operating the way they are, there's nothing wrong with carrying on, but at least he can see side by side there's an alternative that may or may not work better for him. And that's what we're trying to do probably with both our podcasts, is just provide alternatives. People can see that all these options out here have merit, and maybe it's not the same as yours. Maybe it can't be the same. You can't do the same as a given guest, but at least there's something to run some different ideas, just to consider. But
One thing on that, profitability is of utmost importance because without profitability, the farm is not sustainable. And so often, I have this discussion with my dad about profitability because he doesn't think, or I say he doesn't think, he was not, he discouraged me from getting cattle on my own because he's like, you can't make money. I'm like, yes, I can. I've seen it done. I can do it. And I see so many people with that mindset that don't do cattle. Don't try this because you can't make any money. If you're following what everyone else is doing, that may be the case. But if you can think outside the box, and it's not that far out of the box now. There's so many of these podcasts out there to listen, so many great people on YouTube to watch. It's no longer there's no box in present. It's not that far out to take that leap and to go.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good segue into your podcast a little bit. Talk about where that came from, and well, just what is it? Where can people find it? And yeah, what?
So Grazing Grass Podcast, it's available wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you listen to podcasts somewhere and it's not available, I would like to know. Because I think I have it everywhere. Grazing Grass podcasts happen because as I listen to Working Cows podcast with Clay Condrey and these other podcasts out there, I really wanted to hear what producers were doing. And that comes through some other podcasts, but they also have experts on. And to be honest, I didn't want to hear any more from the experts. I wanted to hear what someone's who's successful or trying to be successful. We're all, it's a gamut where we are on that journey, but what they're doing. So I have some technology ability. Like I mentioned before, as technology director for a school. So I know a little bit about technology, but I knew nothing about podcasting. So COVID hit. I'm at home. I'm still having to do some work. I had more free time. I had been publishing some YouTube videos, just kind of on the farm and what we were doing, except we have evolved so much further from where I was then. In May of 2020, I released my first episode of the Grazing Grass podcast, just introducing myself and the idea for it. And for the rest of 2020, it was basically a monthly podcast. I say monthly, that was very loose. Whenever I could find a guest, because I'm reaching out to these people, convincing them to come onto this no-name podcast to share what they're doing. And we had wonderful guests come on and share. 2020, I want to say maybe 13 episodes. I'm not sure. I know the first month of downloads, I had 18 downloads. I was so impressed because that's more than what my mom's going to download. So making progress there. And then 2021, we really started ramping it up and doing more episodes, working towards that weekly show. Of course, with the job and everything else, sometimes that gets difficult. And I want to say we had probably 23 episodes in 21, something about that. During the fall of 21, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. So those people who's gone through a cancer diagnosis knows your world is turned upside down. It completely is. Everything went by the wayside except doing what we had to do and focusing on my wife's treatment. And she went through her chemo, she went through her radiation. She is doing great now. But the podcast definitely went to a back burner. I released the episode every once in a while. I knew at the time I didn't want it to die because I felt like we were it was making a difference and helping people, but I didn't have the energy for it. So 2022, we released a few episodes, and it was really 2023 when we got back on that weekly deal of episodes, and we released 43 episodes in 2023, with obviously the goal being 52 this year, and we're on track right now. But the
Good.
goal, but starting it, I mentioned it earlier, I didn't want experts on here.
Yeah.
I want to talk to people in the trenches, and I hate to say they're not experts because they are.
Yeah.
I want to find out what they're doing. And it's really evolved. Those first episodes, I was very much, how do you do this? What are you doing? How, why? Or not so much why. It's evolved into their journey and what they're doing on their farm now,
Yeah.
which I think those journeys are so important because as we share these stories, someone's listening, and there may be something in my story that reaches someone else that they're like, oh, wait, let me try that. Because it's all about that listener taking that next step to be more regenerative, using managing their soil better, managing their grass, managing their cattle or livestock, or being more profitable. Just that next step. And that's the goal I have with the Grazing Grass podcast, that sharing these journeys and what people are doing that you'll identify with and take that next step. For me, I hear stuff 100 times, and then that next person says it. For some reason, I'm like, I've never heard that. And when I think about it, I've heard it 100 times.
But it
But for
clicks.
some reason, the way that person said it or something about their story reached out to me. It caused me to take that next step. And that's my hope, is we're sharing stories, we're sharing what people's doing, and it's going to cause someone to say, hey, he is not, they're pointing at me, obviously. He's not all that smart. I can do this. So they take that next step.
No, that's good. I share your perspective completely. I really enjoy that, and I try to do the same thing. Sharing stories is so much more powerful to me than sharing data. And I just laughed when you talked about that. I instantly thought of this particular event. I'm not going to share which one it is. It's a large cattle focused event in the country, and I was like, oh, I saw it on Twitter, posted on Twitter. I was like, that looks neat. Let's check it out. And I looked at it, like thousands of farmers and ranchers come to this and stuff, and looked through the speakers, and I just was looking through them again here and stuff. And there's like university, nutritionist, sales, risk management, NCBA, farmland trust, foundation, university, all these speakers. Not like nobody's just like rancher from this ranch. Nobody's just farmer from this farm. And it's like, just tell me their story. It's all the, like, there's like 100, I don't even know how many speakers there are here. And I've been scrolling as you were talking here for a couple of minutes, and I'm not sure that I've seen one that's just like rancher. And it's like, I guess maybe that's something people thousands of people show up, so maybe that's what people want. And people can reach out to me if they think I should start getting on more of the expert folks instead of just the people in the trenches, like you talk about sharing their
Right.
stories. But to me, these are so much more powerful. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Right. And I think there's a place for those experts, and we need them out there. But we need people that's relatable to us, that's been through the same struggles we have.
Absolutely. Well, cool. The last two questions I kind of want to ask you, I try to get from everybody. The first is just what's two, three, or four resources that have been really important in your learning experience and whatnot that you think people should check out? And that can be books, podcasts, conferences, conventions, whatever has been valuable to you.
I hate to even mention this one. I mentioned it a couple of times already, and Greg Judy does a great job of promoting and getting his stuff out there, and his stuff is tremendous. So I hate to bring that up, but that no risk ranching was really transformational for me, because when you talk about no risk ranching, I was like, wait, I don't have land. I'm using dad's land for our sheep and managing his, but I don't have land. I can lease land. I knew I could lease land, but finding lease land, a little bit more difficult. I'm working on an ebook about leasing land that hopefully will be out pretty soon. Just to highlight my process, nothing fancy, just how I go through it. But his book opened my eyes to custom grazing. I've never done custom grazing, but right now I'm searching for more land, and I'm not afraid of it. Because part of my issue on finding leased land was, okay, I get the land. What do I do now? I don't have money to go buy a whole bunch of cows. I don't have money to stock it with stockers. But you can do custom grazing with very little out of your money, out of your pocket money. Let me try that again. With very little money out of your pocket. And that just made a tremendous impact on me. Now, it still took me a few years to really act upon it, and there was a couple catalysts for that, but that book was really important for me. Then conferences. No, I don't love going to conferences. Let me rephrase that. I don't. I'm not as much of an extrovert as people think I am, and talking to people I don't know, just as a story that's kind of funny with me having a podcast. This is really past, but in the first few episodes, way too many episodes, I'd get them scheduled, all the correspondence, what's going on, and then come time to record, and I'd be like, oh, I hope they had something happen so they have to reschedule, because of just that conversation. And a lot of people wouldn't say I'm an introvert, but I fully believe I'm an introvert. And going to conferences is outside of my realm of comfort. But once you get outside it, oh, the networking opportunities, the amount of information you can gain from others. And I really think the networking's the main thing from that. So conferences have been valuable. We went to Hersheep because of that conference in Jefferson City I went to.
And any one
Without
or
it,
two that have been, top that more people could maybe get to, or?
I have not been to enough on a national stage. Mainly, I went to small ruminants up at Lincoln University. I don't know if they still do that. I've been to Greg Judy's Grazing School, Noble Research Institute's doing some schools. So I think those are all beneficial. I'm pitching the idea to my wife that going to the National Grazing Land Conference this winter would be a wonderful vacation. So
Good luck with that one.
she has not accepted or denied it yet.
So
So
you're
I'm
saying
still
there's a chance.
optimistic. But she has clarified that she's not sure I understand the word vacation like she does. So we'll
Well,
see how
I've
that
had
goes.
that. That is actually a more popular thing in agriculture than I think on our honeymoon. We visited a couple ranches. My grandpa, when he left for his honeymoon, they had a cattle trailer behind him. And I've had many people talk about that, going to stock shows and conferences for honeymoons in agriculture. So it's not terribly uncommon, right or wrong.
And then the other resources I have to plug are podcasts and YouTube. There is so much information out there. Podcasts have the great ability that you can listen while doing something else. And they don't require your full attention. So you're able to do that as you're putting in some step-in posts. Now, turn them off sometimes and enjoy nature, enjoy your time out there. But they're a great tool. YouTube, I've got a certain set of channels that I subscribe to that I watch every week. So.
Can you give me one or two of your favorites of each of them, just because I'm curious on specifics?
So on podcasts, it's, you got the Working Cows, you've got Herd Quitter, you got Ranching Reboot, and obviously Grazing Grass. So those are four I really like. And then I go off of ag into some others. There's some other ag podcasts I listen to occasionally, but not as regularly. And then for YouTube, Just a Few Acres Farm. Pete on there runs Dexter Cattle. He does modified grazing, adaptive grazing, because he's not really going out there and doing daily moves that we tell everyone you should be doing. But it's a progression. And what he's doing there, I find a lot of value in. And I think people could benefit if you just take a step that he's doing. And one thing I love that he does is we get summer slump and it's hot. People or cattle don't want to graze. You're not getting grass growing if it's dry. And I haven't convinced my dad of this, but we get short on grass. You pull the cows up and feed hay to them. Let that grass recover and don't overgraze it. Pete does a wonderful job of that. It gets hot and dry, and his grass isn't ready. He pulls them up to his pen at his barn, and he'll hay them till he's got grass out there. And I think there's a lot of value in that. And I just enjoy his authenticness of the channel. I catch Greg Judy's once in a while. I watch a Once a Day Farmer in New Zealand, which I think is interesting because I love dairying and he's milking once a day.
Nice.
Farmer Tyler, I'm interested in his farm. He doesn't do a lot of rotational grazing, but I love watching the farm and seeing what they're doing.
Sure. Awesome. Cool. Last question for you then is just where can people find you or reach out or get more information?
The best way is grazinggrass.com. That's where we've got all the information about the podcast, episodes available, and then you can get to our link to support us and other resources available.
Awesome.
Our farm is called Hedge Apple Acres, but the website is currently down. I hope to fix that pretty soon. But on most social media, you can find Grazing Grass or Hedge Apple Acres.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Cal. This has been great. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story, and I hope people check out the Grazing Grass podcast. It's on my list of regular listens as well. So thanks so much.
Well, Jared, I appreciate you letting me come on and just not stop talking.
That's perfect. The Herd Quitter podcast is brought to you by Faro Cattle Company, whose mission is to help ranchers put more fun and profit into their business. You can get more information on Faro Cattle Company at farocattle.com. And if you enjoy what you've heard on this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Facebook and Instagram at Herd Quitter Podcast or at herdquitterpodcast.com.